Welcome to this edition of the Third Opinion Podcast. We're arguing again today about the presidential election results, and we go in depth on the return of Jeremy Corbyn to Britain's Labour Party. Don't forget to subscribe to Third Opinion wherever you get your podcasts. Now, here's this week's Third Opinion.
Good afternoon, or good evening, or good morning, whenever you're listening to this. This is the Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions. I am Mike Deason.
And I'm Lorene Jaffe.
And we are taping this show. It's Friday. Hope you're having a good day. I want to wish a happy birthday. Now, we may disagree on this, to President-elect Joe Biden.
I will say the presumed president-elect.
Okay.
Just to be technically right under the Constitution.
Okay.
I'm going to call him the presumed. However, as you saw in that article I sent you this week from Alan Dershowitz, highly unlikely, but it may not necessarily be presumed president-elect Joe Biden.
Well, no, but no, even Dershowitz. Dershowitz went through how it could go into the House of Representatives if they can't come through in the states with 270 votes, and then the House each. State gets one vote, and there are more Republican states than Democratic states. But even he says that is not within the realm of realistic expectations.
Yeah, I mean, he says highly unlikely. It's interesting because I don't know if you also know the reporter Van Jones from CNN. He actually did a TED Talk that sort of walked through this process pre-election as well. But, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's interesting. We're seeing more and more whistleblowers who work for various who works at various supervisory of election offices. So they work for supervisor elections, and, you know, more and more whistleblowers coming.
But wait, Lorene.
Yeah.
Lorene, they have gone to court more than 30 times and have presented.
There's 17. Yeah, but there's 17.
Wait. No evidence. Let me finish and I'll let you. The rhetoric they say outside of the courtroom, and then when they get in the courtroom, realizing that as an attorney, as you said last week, obviously you're an attorney, they would be sanctioned if they presented false evidence. They have lost.
I disagree. 30.
They've lost 29 times. They won once on a technicality on the how close the observers could be, and the Democrats didn't oppose it. I got to know.
No, I'm not talking about the observers. So, first of all,
The lawsuits. Do you honestly?
No. There's 17 pending lawsuits from what I understand currently, but I've actually read the affidavits. I've spent a lot of time going through whistleblower affidavits, many of which have just come forth in the last week. And these are people who work for various supervisor of elections office, in particular in Pennsylvania and Michigan, talking about some very serious things that were happening. We already know there was a valid lawsuit in Pennsylvania that's challenging, for instance, ballots that were being counted.
But Lorene, take those ballots that come in after 8 o'clock and throw them out in Pennsylvania. Throw them out.
He
wins Pennsylvania.
Because I am a lawyer.
I'm a journalist. I'm an investigative journalist, and I investigate these things as well. This is pure crap.
I don't think so. I don't think that's fair to say to these, especially these whistleblowers who are employees who are taking.
I have dealt with whistleblowers who have made up things over the years. They do not have any proof. Courts have thrown it out.
That's not true. There's still there's certain cases, but there's about 17 that are still pending. And more whistleblowers, if you've been listening to me for the past week, have been coming forth over the last week. Employees of these very that are talking about very serious. Violations of state law that were occurring. So I think it's a disservice to those people to say that they're made up and false
I think they're doing a disservice to our country and the electoral process. The electoral process needs to be honored. Listen, I didn't like it when Trump.
To be honored, but my point is, if these witnesses who are actually employees are being told to commit violations by their supervisors, and they're coming forth at the risk of their own jobs and saying, listen. You know, I'm trying to do the right thing. Maybe I'm a Democrat. Maybe I voted for Biden, but I saw things that I think need to be talked about. And that's actually healthy for the Democratic electoral process. It's not unhealthy, because if those things are happening, then we need to make sure for fair elections they don't happen in the future. So I disagree. I think that this is a healthy conversation. I think it's unhealthy to call them all liars, because that's not true.
But that's how they've been proven so far. Not one court, except for those observers, moving a little closer to the Democrats, not one court has ruled in favor Not one court has ruled in favor, and no evidence has been provided that has a judge saying, you know, you're right, there's a problem here. No, even
Mike,
Trump appointed judges.
There's 17 open cases. There's 17 open lawsuits. So I think that...
So, okay, let me, bottom line, January 20th, 2021, who's going to be inaugurated as president of the United States?
I don't think anybody can say that with right now. I think that there's... I think I agree with Dershowitz. I think, look, he's obviously the presumed president-elect, but I also think that, you know, we need to let the process play out. And I think it's a disservice to not let it.
Even Tucker Carlson, who I dislike, I think he's really off the wall.
I don't care.
Went on a rant the other night about Sidney Powell, who's one of Trump's lawyers, who just parrots QAnon information. And QAnon obviously is very anti-Semitic as well. But he just said that I've invited her on the show, invited her to say, show the proof. There is no proof. And Joe Biden is going to be the president of the United States. Happy birthday, Joe. Okay.
Right. Well, I'm keeping busy. Happy birthday. I'm just like, you know, I've been through about 100 affidavits. And being a lawyer and having worked through evidentiary evidence and affidavits, I'm going to have to disagree. And I think it's a fair conversation. I think if some of these things are happening,
I think it's a
healthy for people, our process to let it go through the process.
People are not going to believe. We're going to have to disagree on
this. These are people that you know, you don't know. In essence, you're saying Democrats who were our employees who are coming forth because they feel like they witnessed something that was wrong. Like, that's not, it's not fair to do that. So anyway, but let's get to Israel.
We got a lot with Israel, and we're going to disagree on that too. I think Pompeo's trip to Israel was just a showboat opportunity for him to try to place himself in the presidential sweepstakes in 2024. I think it does a disservice to the Biden administration, and there will be a Biden administration. And I think it does a disservice to the two-state solution, because it's driving the Palestinians away. I think it was stupid. It was showboating. And this guy who said, yeah, we'll have a nice second Trump administration, is a hot bag of air that knows nothing. I thought it was a really bad move.
Who are you talking about?
The Secretary of State.
Are you talking about Mike Pompeo? Mike Pompeo was on, I think he was on an 11-nation tour, which included France, it included Qatar.
But going to the West Bank, I'm talking about going to the West Bank settlement.
Well, I don't think so. First of all, when you talk about going to the West Bank, he went to the Golan Heights, which the United States 2 years ago recognized.
No, but he also went to West Bank settlements. He went to West Bank.
That were under Israeli control. So yeah. The West Bank is under, there's three different levels of control. There's area A, B, and C. There's areas that are completely under Israeli control. There's those that are under Palestinian control, and there's those that are under joint control. And that's where he went. But I think what was most interesting about this week and why he was there was because the representative, I believe, was it the foreign minister of Bahrain, was in Israel this week to further the peace accords between Israel and Bahrain. And I thought what was really extraordinary is to continue to announce that Bahrain is now officially going to be opening up an embassy in Israel, which I thought was just, you know, such a tremendous. I mean, this is huge. When we see these the Gulf nations, these Arab states saying, not only do we agree with normalization, we're like real full on active, you know, motions on their part to continue to build upon and not shy away from that relationship. So I thought that was a really tremendous move this week. I was very excited about that. I thought the other thing that was interesting, you know, Pompeo, they're working on. And this has been going on for a while. We've seen some articles on it, working on identifying organizations that support BDS as anti-Semitic organizations. And so that continues to be a dialogue of where they want to go with that. I think, you know, this is an important conversation to be having.
I will agree with I agree with him on their stance that BDS is anti-Semitic. Yeah, and I was pleased to see that. You know.
It's important. It's important that we see, you know, these statements being made from governments and pushing back against, especially when we see, you know, the numbers of Congress who continue to support it, who are, you know, the far left and sort of trying to push that agenda. Although I thought what was so positive this week, the new member of Congress
In New York,
right next to Ocasio-Cortez's Congresswoman Cortez's district.
Yeah, Richie Torres, who's an African American gay representative and very progressive. Go ahead. No, go ahead.
Such a good guy. Such a good guy. And he's like, you know what? I'm not bowing to their extreme positions when it comes to Israel. So he continues to stand and on his position of being a friend of Israel. And, you know, I think that this just demonstrates that you can be a progressive and you don't have to, you know, kowtow to the extremist ideas that Israel's an apartheid state, we should boycott it, and all these other things that are going on in the party right now on that far left side. So I think he is, you know, I hope he's more of the future face of the progressive movement. You know, and maybe he'll have some influence with the others.
I hope, and we will talk more about it. You did a terrific interview coming up a little bit later on in the show, where we're talking a little bit about the progressive movement and what the Democrats need to do with that. But listen, before we get too far afield, you found an interesting thing about autism. Why don't you explain a little bit about that? And it's a special month for WMNF.
Absolutely. So really exciting. So I've known about this program for a couple years now, you know, and we've talked about this before in Israel. You know, all the children serve in the IDF. And if you are a child with autism and you see your siblings going off and serve, you know, it's a matter of honor and privilege and pride. And then you can't go. It's like sort of saying, oh, you're not good enough. And I think, you know, and I hate using the word disability or disabled. I mean, you know, at WMNF this month, we are recognizing people with disabilities. But I find, and this is what IDF said, they said, no, you're not disabled. You're actually extraordinarily abled. And so the IDF introduced this program, Rom Rochok, that empowers youth with autism that are on the autism spectrum to serve in the IDF. And they go through, it's like an 18-month training program where it's as if they're in the IDF, you know, their meals are together, they're, you know, sleeping together.
They are in the IDF, aren't they?
Right. It's an intense training program, and then they officially go into the IDF, and they can serve for 1 year, and if they want, at the end of that 1 year, they can reenlist to do 3 years or 2 years. And what the IDF has discovered is especially people that are on the autism spectrum, they've got this extraordinary sensory ability when it comes to visual and looking and to be able to identify, for instance, you know, movement and their satellites and different things. So just beyond a normal, you know, someone else's ability to do it. And so, you know, working with them to in essence, utilize their skill sets. And, you know, you look at these and you've heard parents talk about it, like how they thought, you know, before this program, they were so concerned, will their child ever be able to live a normal life? Will they ever be able to be, you know, self-sufficient? And then you see the parents when their children come out of these programs, they're like, I have no doubt that my child will be self-sufficient. He'll be able to go out into the workforce, get a job, take care of himself, have a home, because it just opens up this whole new world for them. It's really extraordinary.
And we have a terrific piece here about Rom Rochok and how the parents watched their son change when he became part of the IDF. Let's take a listen.
Neta is our eldest son. He's a very happy boy. He always wanted to be like everybody else.
I would say that in every step of his life, we had question marks. Throughout the way, he struggled all the time with autism, and we struggled to find the right framework that will be the best for him.
He always knew that he wants to go to the army and to do something contributing. It's very important for him to be a part of the community.
IDF is a crucial milestone to go through in order to become a real, proud Israeli. For years, the IDF was closed for people with disabilities.
Rom Rochok program is about taking the visual capabilities of people with autism and making use of these abilities to help the IDF and the intelligence. It's very important to get everybody involved in the IDF. Autistics, for me, it's very important because my son is autistic.
We started the program with the idea that people on the autistic spectrum have special visual capabilities. And there's already science research that's proved that they see different. Some of them are doing aerial photoanalysis. Some of them are doing quality assurance for software. Others, information sorting.
This is not a project of charity. This is a project of excellence. Now, once I was given proof that the kids that are going through the project of Roim Rachok could function in IDF, that's the time when Ono Academic College went into this project and said, let's bring this together and make sure that Israel could be proud of them and they could be proud of Israel.
Roim Rachok program gives these young adults an horizon for the future. We simulate as much the working day in the army so they can get ready. In these 3 months, they learn the military profession as well as how to be a soldier.
I remember the first day that he was getting in his uniform in the army. We saw someone stepping there, coming towards us, and we didn't believe it's our son. He was with uniform, very proud in himself, walking like that, very tall. And this was a very, very exciting moment. You remember that?
Yeah, I do.
There is no difference between Roim Rachok soldiers and regular soldiers. Roim Rachok soldiers interpret satellite images and air photos to acquire relevant terrain data and deliver it to the commanders in the field. Our unit is also called the Eye of the Country. We are working day and night to secure Israel. This is the final task to be safe.
It's a very important job because it's helpful for the IDF to see our enemies and help our troops to know the area. It's a great honor, but also great responsibility.
Once we introduced this program and people see what autistic people can do, I think it changes the way they see them and it changes the stigma about autism.
It's win-win for the IDF, win-win for the guy himself, and win-win for the family and us as society.
Because of this program, I am very optimistic about Netta's capability to integrate into the real life.
I'm sure now that Netta is going to be okay. He's going to be independent and to do the job he needs to do. Whatever he chooses, he will do it, and he will do it right. And he will do it good.
That is really inspiring. That is.
It really is. I mean, I just love that. It's like, we don't see you as being disabled. We see you as being abled, and you have special skills, and we're going to, like, help you develop it. And I love that approach, and I wish that, you know, more countries would look at people with autism and other, you know, quote unquote disabilities that way and say, you know, you actually have, you know, tremendous skill sets and we need to utilize those and work with you on those. So really great program going on there. But, you know, we also have some souring news. You know, we had those latest statistics that came out from the FBI.
It's staggering. It's staggering. The increase in hate crimes up 14%.
Right.
That there's something wrong in this country, in the world. I don't know what all of a sudden is squeezing the tube of toothpaste of hate, but it is just splattering out across the world. And I don't know why it's so much on the rise. I have no earthly explanation on why. I mean, I always know hate has always existed. I understand that. But I don't understand why all of a sudden every year the statistics go up and up, and when you get 10% 1 year and then a 14% the next year, it is just growing almost geometrically.
I know. I mean, they said the FBI said they recorded 953 hate crimes against Jews in 2019, which is a 14% increase from the year prior. So in essence, 60% of all hate crimes against a particular religious group was against Jews. And I, you know, It's so frustrating. And I feel like so much of that, I mean, you and I, we've been talking about it. I mean, yes, there was Poway and horrible things that have been happening, but most of the stuff in the last year, it's New York.
Yeah.
It's all New York based.
New York and Canada. We're seeing a lot of Canada. I mean, that's out of the country, but
right.
Each week,
under Trudeau and then in New York. And I'm just so frustrated. I mean, even Cuomo, I mean, you know, we've talked about Mayor de Blasio, and he's made some really dumb statements, you know, singling out the Jewish community as it concerns COVID.
Right.
Which just baffles my mind, you know, especially being that his city is literally the home to the extraordinary increase in hate crimes against Jews. I'm like, oh, so let's just single them out again and just give more reason to target them. But now, you know, even Cuomo has been saying stupid things about, you know, the Orthodox events, they're the super spreaders.
Well, but he has said that, but he's also talked about some other religious events as well, because the Catholic Church was suing him as well.
So there is that new lawsuit. There's a young, there's a girls' school, a Jewish day school for girls. That they're like, none of them have COVID. Their teachers don't have COVID. None of the students have COVID. They follow tons of protocol, and they're suing them. They're like, you know what? We're going forward with this because you're now infringing on our religious rights. That's a First Amendment right. I have a First Amendment right to do this.
But he's in an untenable position, I think. This is such an extraordinary event in our lives.
You know what? It's not an untenable decision. You know what's an untenable decision? When you send elderly who have COVID back into a nursing home to spread it to other people, that's an untenable decision. When you allow protesters to go out without masks and you don't do anything, those are super spreader events. I mean, I just, you know, to target the religious communities where there are plenty of other.
Let's look here in Tampa. Most of the synagogues are doing online services, and they're meaningful services, It concerns me to be in an event where you're praying, you're singing, you're talking out loud. And
well, then you don't go. I mean, it's a personal choice, right?
But no, we are all in this together.
Look, if I want to go somewhere, I mean, I can go somewhere right now and listen to live music, okay? But if I want to go to a religious service and do that, I mean, no, it's actually, you know what, government, I'm sorry, separation of church and state. Since when do you get to tell me as a Jew when I can go pray?
If they just said no. Jews, I would agree with you. But they're talking about all religious persuasions.
I know, but it doesn't matter. He has no right to do that to religion. It violates the Constitution.
But we're dealing with a pandemic, Maureen. We're dealing with a pandemic.
It doesn't matter. You can't. You still have a constitutional right, and you can only go so far in violating that right. There's a separation of church and state.
I understand that.
Single out religious groups? No.
But no,
I see it being, you know, look, if I want to go, you know, like if I wanted to go for services, I mean, Chabad had a tent outside with separation, with people wearing masks. So if you wanted to attend in person, you could here locally. And I think that's perfectly permissible. I don't think there should be a restriction on that. If I want to go and wear a mask and be outside and attend and participate in services, that should be my choice.
I disagree.
I have freedom in this country.
I understand that, but the greater good is to protect people against this pandemic.
Well, if you're concerned about it, then don't go.
But the problem, that's a great idea. But okay, so you go, let's say, and say you get it, and then you go to the grocery store, and then you spread it to two or three people, and then they spread it to three.
I almost never grocery shop, so.
Well.
but I'm not out and about because I'm also being smart. Look, I mean, that's where the personal responsibility comes in. You have to be smart and safe and make smart decisions. But look, we already know if you're socially distancing and wearing a mask and outside, you already have a 98% less chance of getting COVID if you're outdoors. So you know, these things are, I think our constitutional freedoms are more important at the end of the day. And
listen, I am a libertarian from the word go as far as government intrusion, but I think this is an extraordinary circumstance that has to be dealt with in sometimes in almost draconian measures to protect the entire society.
I don't know. I mean, I make, you know. I've heard too many dictators say that. So
well,
it concerns me. And at some point, enough is enough. Like at some point, you've got to be careful. But I will tell you, the other thing that concerned me this week was Trudeau. You know,
yeah.
Canada under Halpern was a tremendous friend of Israel, especially under at the UN. And, you know, even a greater friend in the United States. I mean, even under, you know, Trudeau's predecessor, I would say Canada was even a bigger friend, stood by Israel, even when the U.S. didn't in certain instances. And so Trudeau has been on this sort of path, as we've talked about, seeing this rise of anti-Semitism in Canada. But he has been on this open path and, you know, joined, you know, Syria. And Venezuela and, you know, all these other human rights violators in engaging in a resolution and condemning Israel at the United Nations. And this is just it was such a stab in the back from Canada that has historically been such a good friend of Israel. And this concerns me when we see, you know, Trudeau jumping in and joining in on this. I mean,
I agree.
He also attacked Macron. Trudeau attacked Macron when Macron was trying to defend his country against extremists trying to murder people. I mean, I don't even know what's going on with his brother.
Yeah, I know. And as we said, anti-Semitism is on the rise in Canada. We see it all the time. And then there is England. I just want to tease this for a bit now because we got to take a break and then I want to come back with the interview, which I think was just terrific. But in England, Jeremy Corbyn, who we all know is a blatant anti-Semite, or at least in my opinion and your opinion, he's a blatant anti-Semite.
Oh my God! Yes.
And it looked like he was being taken care of and being pushed out, but all of a sudden he's back, and we will talk about that after we get back from the break. You are listening to The Third Opinion.
An interview with the UK Bureau Chief of the Committee for Accuracy in Middle East Reporting and Analysis is coming right up. If you want to comment on Third Opinion or make a suggestion, go to our website, thirdopinionpodcast.com. There you can also learn more about our hosts, and you can listen to past shows in our archives. That's thirdopinionpodcast.com. Let's get back to Third Opinion.
The Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions. I'm Mike Deason.
Lorraine Jaffe.
And we were talking before the break about the problems in England and Jeremy Corbyn. And we thought that the Labour Party had ostracized him, kicked him out, and said, we're not going to have that man.
We thought it was over.
Yeah.
Won't go away.
Right. And so you did a great interview this week that focused a lot on that, plus the New Left and the Progressive Party. Why don't you tell us about it, Adam Levac?
Right. So just quickly, so you all, everyone recalls, in late October, the Equality and Human Rights Commission in England investigated Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour Party, and found Jeremy Corbyn directly responsible for a rise in anti-Semitism and his own anti-Semitic acts and conduct. Keir Starmer, the acting head of the Labour Party, immediately suspended Jeremy Corbyn. And of course, Jeremy Corbyn immediately, you know, began whitewashing and denying it. I wasn't anti-Semitic. I never did anything. And anyway, so the internal investigatory arm of the Labour Party, which the EHRC was also very critical of, rescinded the suspension and said, Jeremy, this just this past week, said, Jeremy, you can come back into the Labour Party. So Keir Starmer was furious and he said no. And he did something which they call withholding the whip, which our guest will explain in more detail. But in essence, he said, you might be in Parliament, but you will not sit with Labour. You will not be a part of this party. So we were able to interview Adam Levick, who we've had on the show before. He is the head of the news bureau for the UK with the organization CAMRA that monitors media and rises of anti-Semitism and different things going around the world. Again, his particular area of focus is the UK. And
the first thing you asked him was to explain exactly what CAMRA is all about.
That's right.
And here's Adam Levick.
Sure. CAMRA was founded in 1982. It's a grassroots organization, the largest and most experienced pro-Israel media monitoring organization in the world. We monitor the media and promote accuracy in reporting about Israel in multiple countries and multiple languages. We have departments that monitors the media in Israel, the Hebrew media, the Spanish media, of course the English media, the Arabic media. And we are, you know, our goal, our objective, the mission has never changed. It's to hold editors and journalists accountable to their own editorial standards and ensure that they don't tell lies about Israel and that they don't distort the news and that they report the news fairly and accurately. And, you know, so my colleagues and I are just constantly monitoring the media and trying to get them to correct false claims and trying to promote accuracy. And we also have a campus division which kind of attempts to empower students with the tools necessary to counter anti-Israel and inaccurate messages about Israel on college campuses.
And so today in particular, and I know you focus, your focus is the United Kingdom, and you know, you have done such an amazing job really keeping many of us informed on what is happening in great detail within the Labour Party in the United Kingdom, especially around Jeremy Corbyn. And I know on October 29th of this year, you did a webinar that is still available on CAMRA's website titled Anti-Semitism After Corbyn. Of course, we're going to talk a little bit today about that because Corbyn's still around, unfortunately. We saw, and we talked about on the show, that in October of this year, so I think it was like October 15th or so, 2020, the Equality and Human Rights Commission there in the UK conducted an investigation on Corbyn and released some very scathing findings against him regarding his direct responsibility for a lot of anti-Semitism and anti-Semitic conduct and the rise of hate within the labor organization itself. And we saw that the acting head, the current head of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer, decided to suspend Corbyn. Why don't you, you know, sort of tell the audience a little bit about what really the impact of that report was? I mean, why was it so significant?
First of all, the Equality and Human Rights Commission was set up by a Labour government in 2006. And it is a official government body that enforces the country's equalities laws. So it's not just a commission, it's a government agency whose job it is to ensure that British laws in terms of racism and equality are enforced, and particularly enforced by other government bodies or political organizations. So it has the force of law. It operates under the color of law. Now, these aren't just recommendations. These are findings that require those who it adjudicates on to fulfill their demands. So in this particular case, the EHRC, which, by the way, the only other political party that it investigated for charges of racism other than Labour was the extremist right British National Party. So just to give you some sense where Labour is at this point, that, you know, it's only one of two political parties that have ever been investigated by the EHRC. So the EHRC findings were very clear. It was clear that the Labour Party under Jeremy Corbyn broke the equalities law on anti-Semitism on three counts: harassment, political interference in complaints, and a failure of process. It found serious failings in leadership and an inadequate process for handling anti-Semitism complaints. It also found a lack of willingness by the leadership to tackle anti-Semitism rather than simply an inability to do so. It didn't just say that the process was at fault, though it did find that. It also concluded clearly that there was a lack of willingness by Corbyn and his team to tackle the problem of anti-Semitism. They also concluded, contrary to Corbyn's denials over months and months and months, that his office interfered in the complaints process, which was supposed to be independent of the leader's office, and that that interference in certain complaints allowed for results such that friends of Corbyn or friends of his team were not investigated or were found innocent of anti-Semitism charges. They also found, the EHRC report, that Labour Party officials themselves, two agents of the party, not just members, but two agents of the party, one of whom is the former London Mayor Ken Livingstone, who your viewers, your listeners might remember, engaged in anti-Semitic tropes themselves, which is pretty astonishing. And that Livingstone in particular was found guilty because he accused Jews of using false allegations of anti-Semitism to stifle criticism of Israel, thus basically saying that the victims of anti-Jewish hatred weren't really victims, that they were deceitful, and that they were engaging in accusations falsely. So this was a very serious conclusion, and Keir Starmer, to his credit, decided that, he held a press conference and said that he was shamed by the results, that he would abide by all the specific procedural recommendations that the HRC made, and that he apologized personally and sincerely to the Jewish community in the UK. And then on that same day that the HRC report came out, Corbyn posted on Facebook basically characterizing the HRC report as dramatically overstated, dramatically exaggerated, saying that the report was based on, political bias, political motivations, based on false reports in the media, basically rejecting the report, whereas the new leader, Keir Starmer, accepted it even after, that same day, Corbyn rejected the findings, which led to his being dismissed, suspended from the Labour Party. And then he was readmitted about 9 days later by a committee made up of mostly old Corbyn supporters. Now, after that, something really interesting happened. That is, Keir Starmer reacted to the outrage in the Jewish community to the fact that Corbyn was reinstated to the party by removing his whip, meaning that though he's technically back in the party, within the parliament, he's no longer considered part of the Labour Party. He's essentially an independent backbencher rather than someone who's considered to be part of the Labour Party. So this is an ongoing challenge within the party between the extreme Corbyn wing of the party and the more moderate Keir Starmer wing of the party, and how it turns out, is yet to be seen.
Right. So that's a lot, and people need to understand. So it was, I believe, it was October 29th when the commission's report came out, and immediately Corbyn again, denied his anti-Semitic problem. I mean, he just denied that there was any anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. Just completely ignoring the issue. And how significant this is, and we saw rants and raves about the Jewish issue and the Jewish problem, and people coming out and supporting him immediately. For instance, like here in the United States of America, the Democratic Socialist Party of America, the DSA, came out immediately to extend their arm of support and praise Corbyn. And we know that they're not the only ones. There are certain members of Congress who have been associated with the DSA. Congresswoman Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, who we have talked about on our show, she was a supporter of Corbyn and tweeted support for him when he was running for head of labor. And we're going to get into that in a little bit, but let's sort of break it down. Some of these initial reactions that we saw on October 29th when the report comes out and Keir Starmer decides to suspend Corbyn. Were people with the Jewish community shocked? Were they surprised there in England and London at what was happening, that we finally had some level of vindication, but then immediately, Corbyn and all of his, people around him are like, oh, no, there's no anti-Semitism. I mean, it had to be just really devastating for the community there.
Yeah, I mean, the outrage was palpable. And it really was across the spectrum of the Jewish community. There was a sense after the HRC report that the nightmare was about to, was at its end, that it was going to be solved, that there were better days ahead. And then when Corbyn was suspended, there was also a sense of relief, a sense of, Keir Starmer is at least trying to take the party in the right direction. And just, I want to remind your listeners that, Keir Starmer, he's not someone that's ever been outspoken on the issue of anti-Semitism or anti-Zionism, but, he's not from that extreme left, radical left mold that Corbyn and his supporters are. He's married to a Jewish woman, he's raising his children Jewish, he has extended family in Israel. But I think ultimately for practical reasons, he thinks that if the Labour Party is going to win the next election against the Conservatives, that they're going to have to disassociate themselves from the reputation of anti-Semitism. So anyway, but to get back to your question, there is still a palpable sense of anger within the Jewish community that, A, Corbyn was reinstated, and B, that there's such a pushback, a pro-Corbyn pushback from within the party infrastructure, within the party officials, that, you know, the Corbyn loyalists that are still within the party, they're not letting go. You know, they're fighting back and smearing Jews and smearing Corbyn critics on Twitter and on other forums constantly. So this is raw for the Jewish community, who thought that they'd be able to breathe a sigh of relief. But, you know, the battle for the soul of the Labour Party is still ongoing, and Jews, I think, are still, you know, don't know where this is going to fall.
What about outside the Jewish world? I mean, is this, do the people in the UK outside of the Jewish community, you know, including within the Labour Party, I mean, are they equally as appalled and angry about the fact that, you know, Jeremy Corbyn is still denying his anti-Semitism and trying to whitewash it and pretend like it didn't happen? I mean, is there, you know, is it a global feeling, or is it really, again, just limited to the Jewish world?
That's interesting. I mean, I think it's primarily in the Jewish world. And I think, actually, if anything, there's a lack of willingness to understand that, you know, that far-left anti-Semitism is as serious of a threat as, say, far-right anti-Semitism. You know, there's this, you know, outside the Jewish world, and to some degree within pockets of the Jewish world, but outside the Jewish world, certainly, you know, there's the belief that, you know, maybe it's a bit overstated about Corbyn. There's just a lack of interest into what the scandal involving labor anti-Semitism means for not just the UK, but for other Western style democracies. And I think that's what worries me most, is this lack of willingness to go outside people's comfort zones, right? People that are typically willing to condemn anti-Semitism if it comes from the far right are not, just don't understand how a self-professed anti-racist, which Corbyn always calls himself, someone who is anti-fascist and anti-racist and comes from that tradition, can also be anti-Semitic, such that, you know, in polls, 85% of British Jews thought that he is personally anti-Semitic, not just that he allows anti-Semitism. So yeah, it concerns me that outside of the UK especially, there's really doesn't seem to be much of a lesson learned in terms of what this means, what the fact that that someone who's anti-Semitic came pretty close in the course of two elections to becoming the Prime Minister of the UK. And that's, I think, what worries Jews in the UK and outside the UK, is this lack of understanding about how serious that is and what that means.
Right. Well, you know, so for the listeners again, so we saw just recently, obviously, on Wednesday, November 18th, the party decided to reinstate Corbyn despite the suspension by the Prime Minister, I mean, not the Prime Minister, I'm sorry, the head of the Labour Party, Keir Starmer. And I know the UK-based organization Campaign Against Anti-Semitism released a statement. They're very angry. They said that the quote, the EHRC ruled that Labour's disciplinary processes were unfit, but Sir Keir allowed Mr. Corbyn to be tried under them. Not only that, but Mr. Corbyn should never have been suspended merely for his response to the EHRC's damning report, but for the responsibility he bears for the Labour Party being found guilty of committing unlawful acts of anti-Semitism by the EHRC. And the organization went on to call out for it. It says, Sir Keir needs to get a grip of his party and ensure that Mr. Corbyn is held to account for what he did to Britain's Jews, end quote. And you know, we know that, you know, obviously Keir Starmer, as you mentioned, did take some action in that. He said, fine, if he's going to be reinstated, then you are not going to be identified as being part of the Labour Party. I'm withholding your whip. Now, you, when we go to Parliament, we're sitting in Parliament. Unfortunately, he's still sitting in Parliament.
Right. Meaning right. Corbyn. Right.
But you won't be. But you won't be part of our bloc. So, you know, you won't be meeting with us. You won't be part of the Labour bloc in Parliament.
Exactly.
Does that really have any real impact? I mean, I wonder, will his little faction of the Labour Party still be, you know, conferencing with him and working with him? I don't, you know, is it going to have any real effect?
Well, as long as Corbyn and his supporters within the party, you know, and even if he's outside the party, he still has, like I said, lots of supporters within the party. As long as he's fighting, you know, fighting back against Starmer's efforts to clean the party of the stain of anti-Semitism, as long as they continue to fight, then yeah, I think it's, you know, it's going to mean two things. It's going to mean that the battle for the soul of the Labour Party will continue, that, you know, it's far from over, this fight. And there are, you know, Corbyn loyalists that, you know, both inside the party that, you know, look at this all as a conspiracy, that it's all part of a plot by Blairites and Jews and elites, you know, to bring down their progressive leader. So I don't see any aha moment or any learning moment by Corbyn's loyalists or any reason to believe that they're going to back down. I mean, they might, after a certain point, be forced to, but I don't see that happening anytime soon. So I think they're digging their heels in. So the impact for Jews in the UK and for the Labour Party is grim in terms of that. This fight isn't going anywhere. The Corbyn loyalists are not backing down, and I think that's a very ominous sign.
And you touched on a little bit, you know, the larger global impact. You know, when we see, for instance, obviously here in the United States, we talked on our show about Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez several times because, you know, her refusing to participate in an event that was honoring Yitzhak Rabin, a man who was given the Nobel Peace Prize. You know, he wasn't perfect, but I don't know who is. And then refusing to meet with Jews in her own community. She won't meet with the Jewish Community Women's Council. She won't meet with rabbis. Like, she just refuses in her own district. And she has been very openly supportive of Jeremy Corbyn, as we know. And we see, and, you know, there's been countless incidents by her where we're sort of going, wait a second, you know, why isn't the leadership in the Democratic Party here in America similar to the Labor Party under Corbyn? And we're sort of thinking to ourselves, why aren't they rebuking her or disciplining her and saying, you know, this is racism, and we don't tolerate it. And I think this is a message for us here in the U.S., and you sort of touched on this a little bit, the larger global impact. I mean, what is the words of warning that we here as Jews in the United States, and I hope not just Jews, but anyone who stands up for decency and human rights, should be saying and doing?
Yeah, it's a tough issue. Look, I mean, I think part of it, there's a lot of elements to this, but one of the elements I think is important for people to understand is that there's a difference between the Twitter Democratic Party and the real Democratic Party. Just like when Corbyn was leader, there was a difference between, you know, Twitter Corbynistas and rank-and-file members of the Labour Party. By that, what I'm saying is, you know, under Corbyn, and I think to some degree, the same holds true for AOC, even though she's not party leader. They kind of empower a very active and very activist segment of the party, and kind of create the illusion that they're more powerful than they are. And what that results in is that responsible leaders are afraid to denounce, you know, people like AOC, or in the case of the UK, people like Corbyn, because they're afraid that there's going to be a big pushback from some of the more committed activists that, you know, canvass for the party and turn out in elections. So I think it takes, you know, leadership to look at the impact of this small, relatively small group. And I would argue that people like AOC and Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar represent a relatively small part of the Democratic Party. I think it would take leadership and a lot of some guts for, say, Joe Biden to, you know, really renounce them and, you know, denounce them for their radical agenda. But I think that's the only thing that will work. I mean, you know, at the end of the day, it's going to take someone with leadership to really stick up for Jews and say, no, like, we're not going to tolerate this. And if it means losing support of a small but active portion of the party, then we're going to risk that. You know, I made this case in a post before that, you know, there were a couple of good historical precedents for the ideological or political movement ridding itself of toxic elements. You can look back to the John Birch Society, how in the 1950s and 60s, you know, that extreme conspiratorial right-wing part of the conservative movement was defeated by mainstream conservatives and mainstream Republicans. You can look to how the Democratic Party got rid of communist elements that were entrenched in labor and in Hollywood. But it takes commitment. It takes a willingness to fight some really difficult fights. And I'm a little negative. I don't see that willingness, that recognition from, say, mainstream Democrats that this is a big problem and that they need to, you know, do everything as possible to fight it for the long-term health of the party, for American Jews, and just for their own moral consistency. So, you know, to answer your question, I think it takes leadership and courage, and, you know, there, unfortunately, those are things that are in very short supply, it seems.
That was a fascinating interview, and I thought what he said at the end there about the Democrats dealing with the progressive left and their anti-Israeli stance takes courage.
It does, and I think, you know, we need to be, we can't ignore it. I mean, look, we've got to be outspoken. We cannot ignore the rise, especially of members of Congress, you know, and spreading these lies and this hate. There's got to be some accountability and responsibility, you know, and I just, yeah, I mean, I think it was a really important warning I felt like he was giving us here in America, like, don't let this happen.
You know, it's funny, although they are diametrically opposed, the far right and the far left are able to dominate their parties for some reason that I do not understand, except for fear by other members who, both on the Republicans and Democrats, who know what they're saying can be prejudicial, can be wrong, and nobody wants to stand up, or very few have the temerity to stand up and say, no, you can't say that. You can't do
right,
that.
Right, right. I mean, I'm very concerned. I'm very much watching this, and I think we just have to be very vocal and vigilant. But I thought this is such a timely interview with Adam, and, you know, we're obviously going to keep a very close eye at what happens in England. I mean, God forbid if, you know, Congresswoman Ocasio-Cortez sends out another tweet in support of him. I'm just going to lose it. And somebody in the Democratic leadership better, you know, publicly scold her if she does it.
She has some cachet in the Democratic Party.
What's most frightening is that she has this huge Twitter following of young people who probably know nothing. Like, they know nothing about it, and they don't know better. Like, oh, you know, we're going to flaunt her on the pages of Vanity Fair as if she's like this wonderful, you know, role model and all these other things. But, like, but they don't talk about policies and, like, the things that she stands for, and that, you know, these are real hate issues. I mean, they're really, we got to deal with this. I mean, some of her policies are, like, based on, you know, even, like, we need to track these people and never let them work again. I mean, what are you, I don't understand. Are you communist? Are you Marxist? Like, that's, are you Stalinist? I mean, she said, this is real. And Jews suffered greatly under Stalin. I don't want to go there.
Right.
And this is real. So, but good news this week. I had to tell you, I was at the gym. This is hilarious. I'm working out at the gym on ESPN. I see Hebrew. I'm like, wait, what? I'm like, right, my eye. Like, did I just see Hebrew on ESPN? What is that? So we had, like, number 14 draft pick to the NBA.
No, yeah.
Denny Avdija. He is joining the Washington Wizards. I couldn't believe it. I was like, no way.
Yeah.
We got, I think we have two Israelis.
Yeah, Yamidar was, Danny went in the first round, actually the ninth pick for the Wizards, and then Yamidar went in the second round, and he went to the Boston Celtics. Now, I've got to be honest, I don't think of Jewish basketball players as a big deal. I went to a high school that was predominantly Jewish, and I must admit we did very well in academics. Our basketball and football teams were maybe not. Our baseball team was pretty good, but our basketball. Hey, listen, we're almost out of time. I've got to tell you what I think is the craziest, funny story of the week is a group of Jewish and Muslim bikers in Copenhagen got together to guard a Jewish cemetery, rather, from radical right-wing people who wanted to desecrate it.
It was awesome. Like they're bikers. Like, so people are just, like, you know, Jews as bikers.
That's a thin book, too. That's a thin book. Yeah, I've got my leathers in the closet. Yeah, right.
So, yeah, a Jewish and Muslim biker group, gang, yeah, group, you know, coming together to to defend and protect the cemetery.
I just love that.
Awesome. It was awesome.
Listen, that music, you know what it means? We are out of time. It was a quick show. I hope you all enjoyed it. The interview was great, Laureen. And that's it. This is the Third Opinion, Two Jews, Three Opinions. I am Mike Deason.
Laureen Jaffe.
Bye.
That's our show for this week. Don't forget to subscribe to Third Opinion wherever you get your podcasts. Until next time, thanks for listening.